The Guardian.
Hi, everybody. Max here. Just to say that the news about Yogi Love stepping down as the Germany head coach after Euro 2020 broke, just as we finished recording the pod, we thought about going back in and doing an extra bit. But as you'll hear, Lars spent too much time talking about Marek Hamšík. So we will discuss this in vague detail on Thursday. Otherwise, here's your podcast. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It's a Europod. Benzema rescues Real at the end of the Madrid derby. What does this mean for the title race? And can Barca keep up on the pitch as they welcome a new old president off it? Also in Spain, exciting times for Bilbao. Two Copa del Rey finals in a month. In Italy, Milan scores for Inter to make it 7 wins in a row at the top. A huge week for Juve in the Champions League. And is Zlatan coming out of international retirement? While in Germany, a painful defeat for Dortmund in Der Klassiker. And there's Schalke, making everyone else feel good about themselves. We'll nod to the title race in France, hopefully Lars. Round off the wins for Chelsea and West Ham in the Premier League. And take your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Jawohl, jawohl. Auf geht's.
Have you researched Ligue 1? I mean, I just let you know then. Perhaps I could have told you.
I do watch it occasionally.
Okay, marvellous. That's good enough. Sid Lowe, hello.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm really wonderfully well. Nicky Bandini, nice to see you.
Morning.
Let's start with Spain, because Sid has to go to the dentist at some point. So.
No, that's tomorrow, Max.
Okay, excellent.
Before we establish this, I had the wrong day.
some questions about your dental practices later in the pod.
Oh, good. I'll look forward to those.
So the Madrid derby, Atleti 1, Real 1. Benzema right at the end. Roger says, does Sid think Atleti are going to bottle everything?
Well, what does bottle everything mean? Because they've sort of done the bottling in the Copa del Rey and the Champions League, haven't they? It's just La Liga. I also think as well, you look at Atletico's performances in La Liga, even in this recent wobble where they dropped as many points in 12 days as they had in the whole season until then, it wasn't a kind of a full-on collapse. It was a couple of draws and one defeat against a team that's caused problems for all of the big teams, Levante. And actually, they played very, very well, I thought, for 75, maybe 80 minutes of this derby. They got caught right at the end. Their lead is still significant. It's 3 points over Barcelona. It's 5 points over Real Madrid. They play on Wednesday night against Athletic in that game that they have in hand. So at last, everybody will have played the same number of games. The first time in the whole season, by the way, we'll be looking at the table with a sense of them all being at the same point. And of course, by then, they could well be 8 points clear of Real Madrid and 6 points clear of Barcelona. The problem, I think, in part, has been that all the way through the season, we've been adding in those points. You know, we've been assuming that they're going to win the games in hand, and I'm not sure that's ever a particularly good thing. So I don't think they will completely bottle it, but they're not in a position now where you necessarily say, all right, this team definitely wins the league, not least because, despite the fact that all the focus was on Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid, look at Barca's run. And you start thinking, oh, this is a team that can pick up enough points to definitely compete for the title now. They've not lost in 16. I think they've won 10 of the last 11, drawing the other one. And you know, that means that, of course, that the margins are very fine. So I think I said this weeks ago, Max, the thing with Atletico Madrid is you don't expect a collapse from them, but you do expect maybe a reduction in the rate at which they're picking up points.
But all games in hand are wins.
That's the problem.
Whether it's your team or whether it's... So Cambridge United in League Two have played more than everyone else. So I've added on all the points for all... Even though it's impossible for everyone to win all their games in hand because they might play each other, it's just a psychological thing that we all have with league tables. Talk to us about Kieran Trippier.
Well, I thought he played really, really well. And I think... But it's not just looking at Trippier and saying, what does he do? It's looking at Trippier and saying, what is the impact on everyone around him? And structurally, Trippier is really, really important. I'll give you a few illustrations of Trippier's significance. The fact that he's played every single minute this season in La Liga when he's been available, every single minute. That when he got that ban and then the ban was put on hold, he came back, played 90 minutes, and then the ban was reaffirmed and he disappeared again. He comes back, he goes straight into the team at the weekend, he plays 90 minutes again. The fact that the first game that he wasn't available was against Getafe. The only person who played in that right-back position all season was him. In that game alone, they played with three different men in it. They've had five people play in that position. Six, if you want to include Angel Correa, who kind of played as auxiliary right-back against Chelsea when everybody played in the back. And also, one of the players, and I think we saw this at the weekend in the first goal, one of the players that's played in Trippier's right back position more than anyone else. I say right back because sometimes it's right wing back, sometimes it's right back, was Marcos Llorente. And you constrain him, and he's been Atletico's best player this season. He then gets released by Trippier coming back. And at the weekend, the goal is Trippier's ball up the line, Marcos Llorente's run, his assist, Suarez scores. And that little, I don't know what you call this in English, what do you call it? Combination, I suppose, what the Spanish always describe as a society. That little society between Trippier and Llorente is really, really important for them.
A society has to be more than two players. It can't be like a strike partnership. No,
it can be two players, yeah. They talk about pequeñas sociedades, small societies or small little groups. I mean, you could look, you know, Bruce and Pallister, for example. I don't know, any kind of partnership or any kind of coming together. But obviously, the probably the best one in recent Spanish history, I suppose, is Messi, Neymar and Suarez up front of Barcelona. Or the BBC at Real Madrid.
Is the Arsenal back four a society? Can you have a society of four?
I suppose it probably would be, wouldn't it? Mm. Yeah.
They sort of sit in a line, don't they? They don't, like, sit on a circular table.
Yeah, that's true. It's not interwoven in quite that sense. It's a string.
That Luis Suarez chicken celebration. It's chicken tonight, it looked like. Is that a new... Has he done that all the time and I've just not spotted
it?
Or is that... I Googled... Translated, or I think Pollo Esta Noche is chicken tonight. Has that just arrived? have jars of chicken tonight just arrived in Spain?
No. I suspect that if jars of chicken tonight suddenly arrived in Spain, a lot of Spaniards would find that quite offensive. I mean, you've never seen a kind of a furious response quite like the one in Spain when Jamie Oliver decided to stick chorizo in paella, and people in Spain went absolutely nuts about that. It's like, what? Chorizo in paella? I mean, they were, you know, they were all for... I mean, had he lived here, they would have deported him. It was disgraceful.
Now, on that, Nicky, I saw a video. Someone sent me a video of an Italian chef being very upset about an American putting broccoli in a carbonara.
There's been some fury recently about a New York Times recipe, I think, where they wanted to put some tomato in your carbonara. And everyone knows that if it's got tomato, it's an amatriciana, so it's no longer a carbonara. So I don't know what this madness is. But
why do chefs get upset about this kind of thing? Surely the whole point about being a chef is you experiment and you come up with new things. And why would it upset you?
You have to call it something else.
Italy is definitely a country of particular rules. To sort of draw an example, in Naples there is a body that states what is and isn't officially pizza. And I mean, there's rules about the shape of it, the size of it, all sorts of things that you wouldn't imagine. Of course, in most of Italy, this is not colloquially considered. This is a Neapolitan thing. But yes, for lots of people, they'd be like, well, you know, you can have your tomato and your cheese on bread, but that's just a focaccia. That's something else. That's not a pizza. Pizza has to be.
That's the job that everybody wants, surely. That is like, I mean, that you talk about societies. That's the one to be in, right? How many people are on the board that decide what is a pizza in Naples? You know, we should get back to the football, but the best food judge ever was when the Dalai Lama was a guest judge on Australian MasterChef, which is funny in itself.
I saw that. It was incredible.
But the best thing about it was at the end of the episode, they said, which one do you like best? And the Dalai Lama says, I'm the Dalai Lama. I don't judge. And you're like, well, that's fine. That's fine for everything else, but not for a cooking competition. Anyway.
That is a seriously bad bit of casting. It
really is.
Who's the judge? The one guy that absolutely refuses to judge anything.
Anyway, Barcelona continued their form. You mentioned it. And can they?
Well, I didn't give you an answer to chicken tonight.
Oh yeah,
sorry. I mean, I don't know if you. There isn't one in that he hasn't done that before. As you'll all know, he does his three fingers and his wrist thing, which is the kissing of the wedding ring, the three fingers for his children, and the wrist where the tattoos are. But the chicken tonight thing is new and very directly delivered to the camera. So I'm assuming that is something to do with one of his kids.
You wait until he's the face of Pollo Esta Noche in Spain.
That would be completely brilliant. Luis Suarez says, "Eat pollo esta noche. Don't eat Italian footballers. Eat pollo esta noche."
Didn't Tim Cahill? Tim Cahill always did his punching the corner flag, and then he got sponsored by an airline, and then he just started doing the Janaga Fjortoft, and everyone was like, "Oh wow, a new celebration." And then it was like, "Oh Tim, you've sold out of it there, mate." Anyway, Barcelona, good on the pitch, bit bonkers off the pitch, but. They've got a new president who is an old president. Is this exciting news? What does this mean?
It's very exciting news, I think, for lots of reasons. Let's start with the very basics. The very basics is that it's the end at last of, what is it now, a four-month period of not having a president. And I think that genuinely has made a difference. I think it's put Ronald Koeman in a curious position, and one to which he's, I think, handled quite well in terms of being, if you like, the kind of public face of the entire club, not just as a manager. It finally means that there isn't an interim president. It also, of course, definitively brings the end to, if you like, the old regime, which was problematic for all sorts of reasons. And in particular, I bring that up because if you look at the voting, Laporta didn't just win, he won by miles. And the reason why I think that's significant is that, broadly speaking, and I am simplifying a bit, but broadly speaking, Font and Laporta occupy what you could describe as the same kind of ideological space. And ideological really is the word at Barcelona in terms of the kind of the broad divisions that go back a very long time, which at one point were Cruyff against Núñez, then became kind of Rosell against Laporta, then became Bartomeu against, if you like, kind of Cruyffistas. In terms of that, then, because those two occupy broadly the same kind of ideological space, and Freixa was sort of a continuity candidate, although presented himself as a, you know, I can marry these two warring trenches, we can kind of find a third way. Then I think what it does is it shows a very firm and determined rejection of any continuity, which obviously on the face of it would seem to be entirely logical. How could you possibly continue with the absolute shambles that was Barcelona, continual crisis economically, socially, in sporting terms as well? But actually, when you look at Barcelona's kind of political voting constituency, is very conservative. And so I think that's a really, really significant number. And it gives real legitimacy now, I think, for Laporta to move quite fast and change quite a lot. That said, because it's halfway through the season, I don't think we'll see really big changes in terms of the things that people are interested in right now. In other words, there won't be a change of coach. There's not going to be, obviously, a change of players right now. And I think they'll be cautious about what they say about players coming in, because all you achieve if you do that is you piss off the current players. And, of course, you rely on them to see this season out and to see this season out well, in a season in which they could now well maybe even win the double. And so I think the changes, the really big changes we'll see in the summer, but we're seeing board of director changes already. New CEO coming in, Jordi Cruyff will be running the sporting directorate. The arrival of Mateo Alemany, who was the behind the success of Mallorca when he was there, and behind the recent success of Valencia as well. So I think those are very positive changes from Barcelona's point of view.
That's interesting. Messi seems like such a central figure in all of this. Or is that just
absolutely central.
Yeah, so that's not just a sort of a view from over here, an unknowledgeable view of Barcelona. Like, what happens to him and his relationship with Laporta, it seems huge in all of this.
It conditions everything. What happens to him conditions everything, obviously, for all sorts of reasons, because you can't plan for next season until you know what he's doing. Because not just because it's whether or not Messi is in the team, but it's the amount that you spend on his wages. Although, of course, that would now need to be renegotiated because he needs a new contract one way or the other if he's to continue. And that conditions absolutely everything else, because the percentage of their wage bill that goes to Messi is very, very high indeed. And it's really, really significant. And look, you only have to look at the way that all three candidates kind of had a sort of a battle for ownership over Messi. You know, in terms of, I'm the one that's most likely to make him stay. I'm the one that's most likely to be able to persuade Messi to continue at the club and find a place for him. And Laporta was very, very successful, I think, in doing that. Partly, of course, because he was the president under which Messi won everything before. He's the president that brings in Pep Guardiola. And so Messi is kind of part of the formative era of Messi. I think this is seen in particular, obviously, on Sunday morning. Messi turns up to vote. Messi turns up to vote with his son. There's photographs taken and then him and his son pose in front of the Camp Nou. And there was a real sense that this matters. And this matters because it shows that Messi has some degree of commitment to the club. Now, on one level, you could say, well, perhaps this was a gesture from Messi, in which case it matters because it's a gesture. Perhaps it was cynical, but it still matters that he thought it was important enough to go and make this gesture. And then all of the presidential candidates talked about this, and so did Laporta. Laporta made a big thing in his speech on Sunday night and saying, you know, it's 20 years ago today that Messi made his first appearance for Barcelona, and today he's turned up with his son to vote in presidential elections. That tells you that he loves this club. That tells you that he's committed to it. And Messi has been an absolutely central figure. At no point did he say who he was going to vote for, although we all suspect it was Laporta. Had he done, of course, then that person would have probably won by 85-90%.
So interesting. What's happened to Sevilla, Sid? Because they were flying. I'm sure I predicted them to beat Dortmund in the Champions League, because Dortmund on a bad run and Sevilla on a great run. And since then, Well, they've lost three in a row in the league. And, you know, they've got that. It's a huge game tonight, Tuesday, in the Champions League.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, what's happened to them in part, I think, is the fixture list. I know that's a facile response, but I think in part it's the fixture list. You're right, though. When they lost to Dortmund, I hope I'm not going to get this stat wrong. I think they went into that Dortmund game having not lost in nine and I think having conceded only one goal. And then, of course, they conceded three on the night. Their second half performance was actually pretty good. And then this kind of collapse comes. Now, in a way, as I say, the reason why I say the fixture list is because look at it. And they got beaten by Dortmund, beaten twice by Barcelona. And then at the weekend, admittedly, they were beaten by Elche. But I think that you can look at it in terms of fixture list. You know, they played Dortmund, who are still a good side, however poor their run have been. And I'm not going to claim enough expertise on Germany to be able to give you a proper analysis of Dortmund. And Haaland was absolutely brilliant. At the P1. I mean, watching him was... I don't think I've ever seen anything like it, by the way. Genuinely, live in the stadium. This sense that there's this guy that when he turns and runs, everybody panics. I mean, it was incredible to see. And that shot that he had that was saved and pushed over, he hit it so hard, he didn't seem to swing his leg. And he hit it so hard that the noise of his foot hitting the ball echoed around the stadium. And there was this kind of... There was this audible intake of breath of the few people that were in the ground. And, you know, because in a Champions League night, there's maybe, what, 250 people in the ground, something like that. There was a kind of, like this, when he hit it. It was just amazing. So anyway, to explain Sevilla for you, they got taken apart by him in the first half and then responded well in the second half. They then get beaten by Barcelona, who are Barcelona. They then get beaten again by Barcelona, who are Barcelona. Admittedly, they get beaten by them 2-0, and it's a last-minute goal, and you think of the mental impact that has. It goes to extra time. They lose this weekend to Elche, which is true. That's the one really bad result. But it's a team that's exhausted from midweek, that's got to play Dortmund again 3 days later. So it makes nine changes from the team that had faced Barcelona. And so I think it can partly be explained by that. But there's no doubt that emotionally and physically, they're not in great shape at the moment.
I was just going to say, it seems like the Papu Gomez effect also hasn't been what I hoped it would be.
Yeah. Actually, funny enough, there have been discussions about this. I mean, it's not become a huge debate yet, but certainly there is that question about how well has he fitted in? Does he suit the style of this team? You know, is there something problematic there? I think that's a question that's in the air.
Finally, Sid, Athletic Bilbao have two Copa del Rey finals in April. That's fun, isn't it?
I was going to say I love this. On one level, I absolutely love this. The fact that they got two in a row. They play Real Sociedad. I mean, it's the two perfect finals as well, by the way. One is Real Sociedad, which is the first Basque derby between those two Basque teams in a Copa del Rey final ever. The other is Barcelona, and these are the two teams that have won the Copa del Rey more than anyone else, that are seen as, if you like, kind of the two of the three, obviously, clubs that have never been out of the first division, so it's really, really historic. They have those games back to back, and it's brilliant. But at the same time, for a club like Athletic, to be honest, it's pretty heartbreaking that you have two finals in this period of time and almost certainly no fans there, unless some sort of exception is made for a very small number. And bear in mind, to underline how significant that is, of course, the very fact they've got two in a row is that the first of those two is last year's final. And Athletic Bilbao and Real Sociedad uniquely decided, no, we're going to wait till our fans can be there. As it turned out, even that year-long wait wasn't enough, so they're going to play it. There's one other thing on that, Max, which is great, which is that Marcelino García Toral, the former Valencia manager, who is the Athletic club manager, has been in charge for 2 months. He's already won one final, and he's got two more finals. It's just brilliant, because, of course, he won the Super Cup.
I just like the idea of going, do we rest players in the final for the final? Or do we put our full strength side out for the final and then risk not having a fully fit squad for the final?
Also, because of to make the league fixtures easier to deal with, so that you're, in other words, so that you're only messing with one fixture, they fixed it. So that it was also the weekend of Real Sociedad Athletic Club in the league, which at some stage, of course, they're going to have to play.
Right.
But what I'm saying is what they should do is either say, right, the cup final's worth both, or literally play a double header, finish 90 minutes, then go and do it again.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. No, it's a double header in Southern Amateur League is 1 hour. Half an hour each way, 15 minutes off, half an hour each way. And you can bring as many, you can change your squad totally for the second game.
We did. I remember playing a doubleheader once. I mean, this is sad in a way, but it also makes me laugh. A doubleheader once when we were, I don't know, some Sunday league team, and we were a very young team, mostly kids, I think when we were in the sixth form. And we played this team and we beat them 6-0 in the first game. And we lost the second game 5-0. Which might have been because of the fact that they were a bunch of absolute animals who in the last 10 minutes of the first game, as we were winning 6-0, started to kick the living shit out of us. to the extent that we genuinely bottled the second game to an extent that you would not believe. I mean, genuinely, it was horrific.
Oh, it's great tactics. Thanks, Sid. That'll do for part one. We'll do Italy in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Serie A. Nicky, Milan Skriniar scoring the only goal in Inter's win over Atalanta last night. It was a pretty tight game. That means they reopened their 6-point lead over AC Milan, but it was tight, wasn't it?
I thought it was a really entertaining game. It was, I suppose, short on clear-cut chances, but to me, I don't know if it was just because I was in the moment, but it felt like it was a game that was played at a really high intensity despite the lack of chances. Atalanta did throw everything, including the kitchen sink, at Inter. They were throwing bodies forward. But Inter, look, I sort of feel like I have to keep checking myself because there are 12 games left in the season. That is a good amount of time. The gap, as you say, is 6 points, which is not insurmountable. Juventus are 10 points back, but they have a game in hand. So if they win that, it can be 7. But I think Inter have turned a corner in the last few...
Estella's not having that.
One second.
No, that wasn't Estella. She's in a room, but it wasn't Estella.
Oh no, it was Russ.
Stop, Russ. Stop. No.
Russ, yeah. Not having that at all.
Angry. That was Nicky's stern face, wasn't it?
No. I'm putting that dog outside.
I'm not getting a dog.
You should get a dog, Max.
I don't want a dog.
Dogs are great, Max.
Well, maybe they are, but I don't want one. I don't like them. When I get one, I'll like it. But
yeah, my mistake here was I left, I mean, he could bark anyway, but the mistake in this instance was that I left the blinds up when doing a recording, which is just a guarantee that he'll see something.
Someone outside, you know, he has to have a word.
Yeah.
You were saying you think Inter have turned a corner.
I think Inter have turned a corner. I think they've played well for a lot of this season, but if you look at the last 3 weeks, they go and have this really daunting fixture against the Lazio team, who are flying up the table at that point, who had won 6 games in a row, and they beat them pretty emphatically. They won that game 3-1. Next game is against Milan, who they had just overtaken, but previous to that, they had been following for the entire season, chasing Milan. They beat them 3-0. Now you come and face Atalanta, who'd scored 12 goals in their past 3 games, a team again that comes against them in such good form. Juventus played before them this weekend. Milan played before them this weekend. The pressure isn't, like, so intense because they've built some gap, but still, this is one of those games where the timing of it feels like, okay, this is something that you have to overcome. This is a definite opportunity to slip up against a really good team that's scoring goals in buckets. So to win that in this way, to keep a clean sheet, sure. I saw some people afterwards say, look, Inter only had one shot on target. And it's true. But once you've scored with that one shot on target, it's not on you to play beautiful football for everyone. If you can win the game as they did, without really giving up any great chances after that goal to Atalanta, to me, it just shows a steal that we haven't seen from Inter in so, so long. And in fact, what this made me think of is how many times in the last few seasons we've had weekends like that where Juventus were leading the pack and the other teams won ahead of them. And you thought, ooh, a little bit of pressure here. And then actually, Juventus just strode through it and went on to win a title. To me, that felt like this weekend, but for Inter instead of Juventus.
I think maybe the steeliness you mentioned is a point here, because obviously we're kind of used to Inter being a bit mad, and you'd expect Inter-Atalanta to be at least 5-4, if not more. So the fact that they restrained Atalanta, like, I was two-screening this. I had this on the second one, and I had the sort of random madness of Bielsa's leads on the other screen. And like you say, there weren't that many big chances. And when you're playing against Atalanta and there aren't that many chances in the game, you're kind of doing things right, especially if you end up winning it.
And I thought as well, I mean, we've talked about Lukaku a lot, and he is brilliant, and it didn't quite come off for him, but the defending against Lukaku was kind of like desperately last ditch. You know, it was like he didn't score, but like for that to happen, Atalanta, it wasn't like they kept him quiet at all. Like Sid talked about Haaland earlier, and I think there are some similarities in just quite how sensational these two players are.
Yeah, I mean, Lukaku's been absolutely on fire and was the player carrying them through a lot of this month and delivering against Lazio, delivering against Milan, very much front and centre. He didn't score in this game. There was one chance, I think, is probably the one you're thinking of, Max, in once they were already 1-0 up, where he does get in behind and he has, unfortunately, to play to the stereotype that everyone likes to play to, it wasn't his greatest touch and he did not get the ball ahead of himself and the defence was able to recover and it could have been 2-0 at that point and perhaps it should have been. But his performance overall this season has been a standout. He's been, I think, well, not I think, he's been without question the most important player in that Inter team if you want to talk about individuals. But again, what's impressive with where Inter are now is there were times in this season when it was just Lukaku carrying them, frankly. And then there were times when it was Lukaku and Lautaro carrying them because he's also been great. But this was the team which you looked at and thought, well, hang on, there's Milan Skriniar who scored the goal, but who also wasn't even in the team at the beginning of this season. He was dropped because Conte didn't feel like he could play in a back three and he didn't fit the system. Now there he is playing and keeping another clean sheet, of which Inter have had heaps recently, which they didn't have earlier in the season. There's Christian Eriksen, who was this great, unwanted, uncomfortable fit in the team, suddenly is absolutely integral to it, and Conte is reveling in that. Everything is falling into place for Conte at this point of the season, including, and this was my other little favourite moment, after the game, Conte on Inter TV gives an interview saying, we didn't just win, we didn't just keep a clean sheet, but I thought it was a really mature performance because nobody got booked. Look how you know good a job we did. And then Stefan de Vrij, who's there with him at the same time, goes, actually, boss, someone did get booked. You.
That's brilliant. What about Alexis Sanchez? He scored two last week and he said, I'm like a lion. The more I play, the better I feel. I'm not sure that's...
Is that how the lion is defined? It's by playing a lot.
That's why so many lions are out of form. They're just not getting picked.
He's been hanging out with Ibra as well. These people have got to stop comparing themselves to grassland animals.
Yeah, exactly.
I disagree. You know, one of my favourite discoveries years ago, reporting on the NFL's scouting combine for college athletes who are coming in to play professionally in the NFL. And at the scouting combine, when I covered it one time, I was asking people about the questions they'd been asked by teams, because teams go there and they send their scouts. And apparently one team was asking every player which animal you would be if you could be an animal. More athletes should be made to answer that question because the answers are just funny.
Okay, then. I would be a cat. No, I don't sleep that much, actually. I just... Seems like
we are going very Partridge here. This is
okay, yeah, you're right. I'll stop it. You're right.
Moody. People think you care, but you don't.
Thank you, Sid, for stopping us. Thank you so much. You mentioned going Partridge. I once asked a Formula One driver if ever, I can't remember who it was.
He can, though. He can remember
did
it well.
Did he ever, well, I of all the stupid questions I've asked, I asked him if he got ever zoned out and thought about doing the shopping. And then someone sent me a Partridge script where he literally asks that question.
Oh, wow.
I also asked a cyclist who was trying for the record round a velodrome in an hour if he got dizzy. And I thought it was quite a good question. And then Barry's favourite is, we were interviewing the UK foot golf champion. You know, like when it's golf, but with a football and big holes and you just kick it. And it's good, you know, goalkeepers would be good at it. And I asked him if he had a caddy. when you think about it. Anyway.
I mean, you could have a bag, a bloke carrying around a big bag with different boots in, depending on what
exactly.
Kind of
predators.
Strike you want. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Predators, if you've got a dog leg, that kind of thing. It was, you know, not what leg should I... I'll get your left leg out of the bag for this one, Dave.
I have played foot golf, and you might want a bag of spare balls, because when we played, there was definitely about 15 minutes spent trying to persuade a ball to come back from the middle of a pond, so...
Oh, really? Okay, well, there you go. AC Milan lost to Inter, drew with Udinese in the last month, and they've got Manchester United on Thursday, which is the standout tie in the Europa League. What are you expecting from that?
Milan have definitely dropped in the last month or so. They've gone from having led Serie A for the whole season, and it feels tough. I saw a stat after the weekend. They're the first Italian team to have reached 100 points since the start of 2020. And you think, it's that kind of form that feels like it should have earned them a title, but because it was the end of last season and the start of this season, it's probably not going to. Their form has gone. They've lost important games. But at the same time, I look at this weekend and with Ibrahimovic out, with Ismael Benacer out, with no Teo Hernandez, some other players missing, some other sort of really important first-team players, they get this win. They get it with goals from Rodri Krunic and Diogo Dalot, who have played barely at all this season. And I do think that Stefano Pioli has done this incredible job of continuing to draw more and more from that squad, players who you didn't think of contributing. They're not coming into this game against Manchester United at anything like their height. If this game was 2 months ago, I think if you were talking about the different trajectories of the clubs at that point, you might have thought that this was a really strong tie for Milan. But I have a hard time with how up and down they've been in the league recently and how Manchester United are coming up, seeing Milan getting this one. But hopefully we'll get some nonsense, some magic from Ibra, and at least a good tie out of it.
I saw rumours of Zlatan coming out of international retirement, which would be great, wouldn't it, for the Euros?
I have been speaking to a Swedish colleague who doesn't think it would be so good, or possibly is a bit tired of the Zlatan story.
I'm sure.
But talent-wise, of course, he's shown he can contribute still, and I'm sure he could do something for the national team just as he has for Milan.
Lots of generic questions on Twitter about whether Ronaldo's a success or a failure or not, which are, you know, talking about tired questions about Zlatan. You know, if Juventus win the Champions League, it's all been worth it. If they don't...
It's an interesting question. No?
This game tonight against Porto, they're 2-1 down. It's such a huge game for their season now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Juventus had got a really good win of their own. They were 1-0 down against Lazio with Ronaldo on the bench, rested for this game, and they came back to win that really comfortably in the end. So they had a good result this weekend, interestingly, without him on the pitch. But he's their leading scorer still. He scored 20 goals this season in Serie A. Of course, he's the guy who you're looking to and expecting to deliver you in this tie against Porto. Whether or not his signing has been a success, I think that's so layered. Because on a business standpoint, there's no question it's been a success. Juventus' brand has been elevated hugely by Ronaldo being there for these seasons. It feels ridiculous to say that we're talking about Juventus, who are a huge club, who have all of their own reasons for international standing, but that is modern football. Ronaldo and Messi and a handful of others carry so much attention that him being there has done good things for the club's brand. So look, when he signed, they said they wanted to win the Champions League. Juventus were explicit about it. Agnelli said it. Allegri, who was the manager at the time, said it. If it doesn't happen, that will be a letdown on some level, whether or not they might still look at it afterwards and go, it did what we wanted for the club. Maybe that's a different conversation.
I just think, I mean, I think Wilson wrote about this or along similar lines in the paper at the weekend. It is an issue with him because obviously he scored what, 20 goals in 20 league starts, so you can't really fault him for that. But I mean, Pirlo wants to create an identity here, and at least based on what he said, he seems to want to press high up the pitch and be assertive in all of this. And it is a challenge then if you have one player who just doesn't offer you anything without the ball, like nothing. And again, shout out to the FB Ref website. If you look at like pressures, like how much pressing he does without the ball, compared to other strikers in the big five leagues, he's in the bottom 1 percentile. Like, he doesn't do anything without the ball. And maybe you don't want Ronaldo to run around like a greyhound and press opponents, because that's not where you want him to use his energy. But it really does restrain you in terms of how you can play, like how you can set up the team, if you have to have this guy there and he doesn't do anything.
Can I ask a question from the point of view of someone who's absolutely not an expert and doesn't watch enough or hardly any Italian football?
Yes, I'm ready to answer.
Okay. Does he literally do nothing except score, or does he do other things as well?
The problem with all of these questions is, I think that the answer to what he does is different even now, much though we don't like to talk about it, than what it was 2 years ago. Everyone wants to believe that these superstars remain exactly where they were in perpetuity. And I think, honestly, my eye test, I'm reluctant to say it because I think that people do jump on these very aggressively. I think he has done less for the team this year than he has in previous seasons. And I also think Juventus are at a really awkward moment now in that transition. I think 2 years ago, you were still just trying to win the Champions League. You had that core defensively that you had before. You were still in that team that had already gone to two finals. This team now, for better or for worse, is trying at the same time to rejuvenate. And some of that is going really well. Federico Chiesa has been unbelievably good these last few weeks for me. I think he's been so far ahead of where I thought he was going to be. De Ligt, in my opinion, has really coming in the right direction. I think Morata's been a great signing to bring back. Weston McKennie's been a really positive impact this season. Where does Ronaldo fit in that story? He doesn't so much. And that's the awkward point. Lars is right. He doesn't press. And the team is different when he's there. I'm not sure I can go as far as to say he's not doing anything for the team, because I think Ronaldo, first of all, by his presence, does something for the team. Everyone defends differently when you have Ronaldo on the pitch. Everyone behaves differently. And it's not like he does nothing for the team's build-up play. That's completely unfair. But he isn't a high-tempo pressing player, and that is what the team looks more like when he's not there.
At the bottom of Serie A, Nikki, Crotone have lost 19 out of 26, which is quite a lot of games.
They have. They won this weekend, which was a surprise to me, because they've just hired Serse Cosmi, who I've been trying to reach for what the right English equivalent would be for people to understand him by. Like, imagine if Sam Allardyce was like a division or two less successful, really, because Allardyce actually has done quite well in the top flight. Cosmi...
Barry Fry, okay.
Maybe. Cosmi has had his moments in the top flight, but they're quite a long time ago. He has this very out there character where he's just a lot. I don't know how else to describe him. And he once gave an interview where he talked about showing his players porn on the team bus, because right, that's how you get them ready for a game. He's a lot. And I've not been hugely convinced by his management in the past, but Crotone hadn't won. And now they have. They beat Torino, who are a relegation rival. It was actually a really fun game, which ended with Aram Unas gets absolutely destroyed by Thomas Rincon. Horrible foul, red card. Gets up and does this ridiculous dribble past two players and scores a brilliant goal to end the game. It was a really entertaining game. Perhaps there is some unexpected chapter coming in the Serse Cosmi story, because, yeah, he's a character, I think we can say.
Reading between the lines, you don't have to. I think you saying someone's a lot, it sounds like the it sounds like he's terrible. You know, like sort of Mr. Banter Boy. He's like the banter boy of Italian football. That, or banter man, banter old man, which is even worse, isn't it?
We've also now raised the specter of being shown porn by Sam Allardyce, which I think is something we would all desperately like to not experience.
There's an important nuance there. It's shown porn by Sam Allardyce, yeah, not shown porn with Sam Allardyce, which would be significantly worse.
And we'll end part two there. We'll go to the Bundesliga next. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Lars Sivertsen's Bundesliga Rundschau. Ah,
das Rundfunk is here.
So, like, Der Klassiker, right? I mean, Dortmund. Oh. Because I can't remember. There must have been another game on at the same time, because there's always a game on. But I just was looking at Twitter, was just going, Haaland, Haaland, Haaland. This is amazing. And I was like, oh, Dortmund are going to beat Bayern. I should watch this. And then Dortmund didn't beat Bayern.
Well, let me just say, first of all, in some ways, this was a slight step in the right direction for Dortmund. Now, before you send for the ambulances and the men in white coats, I have to preface this by saying Dortmund have been atrocious in their last few visits to the Allianz Arena. Like, they've been so bad. It was their seventh straight defeat away to Bayern. And the last six games, I think they've lost by an aggregate score of 26-3. They've had a really bad time away to Bayern recently. Yeah, November 2019, they lost 4-0. Spring of 2019, I remember that was particularly dismal, because they lost 5-0 and they were still in the title race then, and we thought they were going to go there and do something, and they just didn't turn up at all. And the backdrop for this is that, and also the fact that they had no Jadon Sancho, this is their second most important player, no Rafa Guerrero, one of their best players this season. Witzel is out for the long term, probably their most competent central midfielder. You know, Akanji was out. He'd probably start at the back. I'm not a huge fan, but he'd probably be starting. Gio Reyna was out. So they were missing a lot of guys going somewhere where they have a recent history of not turning up at all. So the scene was kind of set for another thumping. And they did at least turn up. And they took a 2-0 lead, as you rightly pointed out. And they really pressed Bayern in the first half and sort of got amongst them and didn't make life easy for them, which is the thing that's been so disappointing about this fixture in the past, in the recent past. But they ran out of steam and they can't defend. And Haaland had to go out injured, and Bayern did their thing. We can talk about Lewandowski versus Haaland, but again, I thought we saw examples of Lewandowski having a slightly better supporting cast, I have to say. And there was one chance in particular in the first half when Meunier could have put Haaland through for a hat-trick, and he just messed up a really simple pass. And maybe Dortmund being Dortmund, 3-0, they could have messed up that as well, I'm sure. But, you know, it's frustrating with them. And I feel you have to be a little bit critical of some of the more experienced Dortmund players here. For instance, I mean, at 2-2, it was 2-2 until it was a couple of minutes left. And at which point, Emre Can lost the sort of 50-50 shoulder-to-shoulder challenge with Leroy Sané, and Bayern went on to score. And Royce was really angry and talked after the game about, oh, well, you know, this should have been a free kick, and if it had been Bayern, it would be a free kick. And this is completely besides the point. Emre Can, you cannot be out-muscled by Leroy Sané when you're trying to hold on to a point away to Bayern Munich. Like, you're meant to be one of the sort of slightly more experienced, you know, rugged defensive guys here. And it was very, very frustrating because it was more of the same in a sense. They're exciting going forward, Dortmund, but they're not canny. You can't really rely on them. But at least they turned up and they weren't embarrassed.
Emre Can said, if you only play well for 10 minutes against Bayern, it's going to be tough. That sort of seems correct. Yes, you know, that's a fact.
Yeah, I think he's being a little bit harsh. I think because they were first half by and large, they were pressing, they were doing the things, but they ran out of steam. And I think this is a team that under Lucien Favre played quite conservatively and often sort of waited for the opponent to come onto them. And under Edin Terzic now, they're trying to be more assertive, be a little bit more. I mean, they're forever pining for the glory days of Jurgen Klopp, and I think this might be a salutary lesson for Liverpool here, I guess, is that they've never fully replaced him in a sense, and it's always when things aren't going right at Dortmund, it's like, oh, God, I wish we were pressing and running a lot like under Klopp again. And then the feeling is now they're going to try to run more, but it's hard to sort of do that mid-season. Suddenly, we're going to press a lot more than we have done all year. Like, they're
sure,
maybe
especially this season of all seasons.
Yeah, then maybe not entirely fit. There was a real sense that they ran out of steam, I think, in this game, and they just couldn't do it physically anymore. You can overcomplicate this, and God knows I overcomplicate this in many other things, but if you make Bayern and Dortmund combined 11, like, I mean, you have to get Haaland in somehow, even you have to waggle the formation a bit to get him and Lewandowski to fit at the same time. Sancho would get in, I guess, and then maybe Hummels, I guess, but probably not. I mean, I don't know if there's anyone else there, really.
That you've just mentioned it, so I'm going to jump in and ask the obvious and very basic and probably sad question, which is, if you do a combined 11 of these two teams, Haaland gets in it. Well, given that everyone's talking about the future, and as you can imagine, in Spain, everyone's banging on about whether Haaland goes to Madrid or to Barcelona or to one of the big Premier League teams, is he not just going to turn up at Bayern Munich, like everyone who's good at a club that's not Bayern Munich in Germany?
The challenge with that, it's a little bit to do with the fact that Lewandowski probably has another couple of good years in him.
And are they not compatible?
I don't think so, because they're both, you know, very clear number nines. I mean, maybe you could devise some sort of strategy. But again, as you know, if you want to play with two number nines, that really does restrict what you do with the rest of your team and how you set it up. I think it would be a huge challenge to do it. And I wonder if they're maybe not compatible. And also the fact that Dortmund, I mean, if it was to happen this summer, Bayern would have to pay the kind of transfer fee that they just don't pay.
Do you think Haaland will go in the summer? Do you think, because you sort of think if you're him, you've outgrown, I mean, almost literally, but you've outgrown Dortmund now.
So there's no plan that I'm aware of right now. It's a few weeks back, I was made to understand that that's not a plan at all. But circumstances will obviously change a little bit if they don't make the Champions League. He's been very vocal about the fact, you know, I love playing in the Champions League. That's the competition I want to be in for every year for the rest of my career, he's said. And he was pressed by Norwegian TV on this, you know, what happens if Dortmund don't qualify? And Haaland being Haaland, he said, you know, no, that's not an option. We're going to do it. That's obviously what Haaland's going to say. But I do think that changes the equation ever so slightly, not just because he wants to be in it, but also that will severely limit Dortmund's ability to put together a team that can challenge for things next season. Because, I mean, Jadon Sancho is almost certainly going. I mean, that's the assumption. And if they miss out on the Champions League, they might have to sell someone else. It'll be hard for them to buy anyone. I mean, financially, the numbers don't make sense already because the pandemic, obviously, Dortmund have been hit by anyone like everyone else. But if they miss out on the Champions League, it really starts looking tricky for them. So that might change the equation a bit. But also, it's going to be one of those summers. I don't think there's a ton of money going around in the market. I mean, Sid, you must get this whenever you see the newspaper rumors. Yeah, Barcelona is going to sign this guy and Real Madrid is going to sign that. Like, with whose money? Like, how are they doing this?
Well, and of course, the answer to that question is, if you look over the last 3 or 4 years, they're not doing it.
Yeah.
The last two markets in particular for these two clubs have been almost dead.
And it looks like it'll be more of the same this summer. So I'm not convinced he leaves. And I think what's worth remembering with Haaland as well, I mean, he's the real deal. He's very clearly the real deal. And they don't have to freak out and panic and worry and try to get him to the top as soon as possible. Like, unless he gets bad injuries, he's going to be at the top level for a long time going forward. It's not as if he's had one great season and people feel like, oh my God, we have to cash in on this sort of it moment. I think they can look at him and his performances and feel very confident that actually this guy is going to score a ton of goals next season as well. So all the options he has now, he's going to have next year anyway. So they're not in a hurry to move him on.
Sure. If he wants Champions League football, I guess perhaps West Ham next year. RB Leipzig have won 5 in a row. Beat Freiburg 3-0. Kevin Campbell bossing the midfield. He's doing well, isn't he, considering how old he is? Isn't he? Sorry.
Very good. You couldn't stop yourself. No, but they went away to Freiburg, which is not necessarily an easy place to go, and won on the back of beating Wolfsburg in the cup, on the back of beating Gladbach. So you know, good stuff. I think, obviously, big weekend for tall Norwegians. Haaland scoring twice, but also Alex Sørloth scoring again for Leipzig, or as I'm sure Thomas Müller would call him, Alexander Skorlo.
Oh, good.
He scored again. Now, some would argue, our good friend Andy Bressel argued, that he did a bit of a David Nugent and sort of nicked the goal off of Christopher Nkunku. But I would say that Alexander Sørloth is he's a very perceptive player, and he just knew Christopher Nkunku was going to miss, even if he was past the goalkeeper, so he just tucked it in. But no, having a striker is good for Leipzig, if Sørloth can keep scoring. They are second in the Bundesliga, and then keeping up the pressure on Bayern. But at this point in the season, Christopher Nkunku is their top scorer with 6 goals. So they're doing this without really having a striker who's been doing the business for them, which is impressive in a way, but it's also makes you think, yeah, if they just had a forward, maybe things would be even better. So Alex Sørloth starting to score is big news for them. And I think, looking ahead at the Liverpool game, obviously the first game was a bit of an aberration from their perspective. I think they felt there was a real chance to do something there, and they didn't, and that was frustrating for them. But I think they'll feel something can be done there still, even if it's a big deficit to overcome, just looking at how wobbly Liverpool have been.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. How are the rest of the Champions League places lining up? I mean, apart from Leverkusen, they all had a bad time this weekend.
Yeah, so Leverkusen won, very important game for them this weekend. But this is also the thing, when I was talking about how this maybe wasn't the sort of catastrophical weekend from Dortmund it might look like, because Wolfsburg lost very, very unexpectedly. Wolfsburg lost to Hoffenheim, which never quite saw coming. And Eintracht Frankfurt drop points, which mean that Dortmund, they now have their very winnable games after the Sevilla thing for their next sort of couple of games. They've been playing Hertha Berlin, who are struggling near the bottom, and who might actually get themselves relegated, and what a story that would be, given the investment they've had over the last couple of years. Cologne they've got after that, who are also battling relegation, or Köln, we should say, on the Europod. And that would set it very nicely up for the big game against Frankfurt. Now, I will mention, just because I think it might intrigue Nicky more than anything, and maybe Sid as well, Andres Silva has really sort of lost the run of himself and been quite fantastic for Frankfurt, scoring 19 in 22 this season. Now, of course, some of us might remember Andreas Silva as one of those players that Milan bought a few years back when they were owned by this mysterious Chinese man who may or may not have had any money. And then they spent a ton of money on a lot of players, very few of which turned out very well. So I guess you could say that currently Andreas Silva is starting to look like the player Milan thought they bought with the money they thought they had a few years ago. And none of those things turned out very well for them. But currently he's very good.
How's life at Schalke, Lars?
Terrible. Very bad. How much time do we have? I wanted to mention this because I feel like they've reached some sort of nadir now, I hope, for their sake.
Right, okay.
And I'm not just cross because I spent 2 hours of my Friday night watching this game and it was really bad. But okay, so Schalke, You may remember they brought in Christian Gross to much hilarity. I mean, he was and he was very much seen as a last resort. You know, he's old school to the point of being, well, let's not even go there. He's quite old school. And but at least he might impose some discipline and get them running. He isn't someone who, if you're Schalke, you really want Christian Gross to be your manager. But if nothing's working and everything's going wrong, might as well try it. Well, now the last resort has been fired. Along with the sporting director, the team coordinator, the head fitness coach, and the assistant coach have all gone. They've just kind of fired everything.
Right.
It's like that scene in Leon when Gary Oldman says, "Bring me everyone," and someone says, "Everyone? Well, everyone!" Like the Schalke just fire all the people. They fire everyone.
They're on except the players, right?
Well, because that's kind of hard to do, isn't
this,
it?
This would be the real solution.
They're the first club in the history of the Bundesliga to be on their fifth coach in one season. With David Wagner being replaced by Manuel Baum, with then Hoob Stevens coming in for a bit, then Christian Gross, and now Dimitris Gramozis. And apparently there was a player revolt led by Sead Kolasinac, Mustafi Huntelaar, these guys who've been around a bit, who, according to the German media, went to the management of the team and said, like, Christian Gross, he's getting our names wrong and speaking in the wrong languages. And, like, it's not very good. We can't have this. It's very odd anyway. So they sacked everyone. Right. And hopefully when you've had this sort of really running out of people to sack at this point, they're then playing Mainz this Friday, who are, I think, the worst team in the league not named Schalke. So you'd think they might be able to do something in this game. And it was just appalling. It was really bad. They had two shots over 90 minutes against the second worst team in the league at home, and it ended 0-0, so they got a point, which I guess for Schalke is pretty good, but it, oh my god, it was so bad. And I mean, they're going down, and we got to bear in mind this in terms of support, certainly in terms of members, this is the third biggest club in Germany. So like, it's so going down and going down in this manner is unbelievable. You got 10 points from 24 games.
Can you give us a Premier League equivalent?
Everton. It sounds like Everton.
Yeah, maybe
sort of.
They are a very big club, Schalke, and wow. So for this to happen is extraordinary. They're going down. They're bringing with them €250 million in debt. So you can say that going down might be good for them because the squad needs to be broken up and sold for scrap, and they need a rebuild. But since they're bringing down financial constraints with them, and there'll be a huge target in the second division next season, everyone's going to want to go to Schalke and get a win there. So there's a chance for them to rebuild, but to do that, they're going to have to be the smartest guys in the room after a recent period of their history in which they have not been that, put it mildly.
Chris says Liga is an interesting title race for once. And then he writes question marks. And then puts two question marks. Lille top, PSG, Lyon, possibly Monaco. I mean, we just presume when you get down to the Ligue 1 table that PSG will be 20 points clear.
Yeah, no, they aren't. Lille have been quite remarkable in the way they've kept it up. And they're still top of the table. Lille, very difficult to beat. They're managed by Christophe Galtier, who's like a very canny, sort of quite defensive-minded manager. Their team was put together by the sort of very highly rated sporting director, Luis Campos, before he left this winter after there was a change of ownership. But if you look at the team, they've got the balance right, because they were a club certainly previously owned by the same guys who own Milan, and they had a similar model in the sense that they were looking to youth. So they have the Dutch defender Sven Botman, who's going to go for some money in the summer. He's been very good, and they have some Jonathan David, the highly rated young Canadian they have. But they also did stuff like bring in 35-year-old Burak Yilmaz, who's actually their joint top scorer. So they've struck a good balance there, and they have a very canny manager. Renato Sanchez, former loney misfit at Swansea, has played some good games this season. Looks like
he passed the ball to the advertising hoarding, or to a steward, didn't he?
Yeah, looks like looks like there might be a player there after all. So yeah, a good balanced team, very defensive, very structured, canny manager who gets the results out of them. So would be quite something if they keep up the pace. Also bearing in mind there was a change of ownership in the winter, so it's been a bit of an interesting year at Lille.
Now, Premier League fans, of which I presume there are some listening to this, wins for Chelsea and West Ham last night. Chelsea pretty comfortable. Tuchel doing a wonderful job, actually. Kai Havertz played really well as well. Is this the Leverkusen Havertz, Lars?
Well, the sort of role he played yesterday was quite a free one. He was allowed to drift around and sort of find space where if you look at his touch map, he was kind of playing everywhere. Which is more familiar to the role he was playing before. Yeah. And also just with Havertz, listen. This is a guy who's been playing very, very well for a couple of years, who moved then to a new country in the middle of a pandemic, had COVID himself, and maybe didn't have a clear place in the team because he was played a number of different positions. We shouldn't maybe be that surprised that he struggled initially. Like, we shouldn't be surprised. Hey, it turns out this guy who's been good for several years and who all the top clubs in the world wanted is actually really good after all. Like, this should not be a huge surprise to us. If you look at them now and what they're doing so well under Tuchel and why they keep winning games, the first thing you think about is like how well structured they are and how well organized they are and how everyone seems to stay and stand where they should stand and keep the shape. I feel like it doesn't reflect enormously well on Frank Lampard that the biggest problem under him has suddenly become their greatest strength just kind of almost overnight.
Yeah, and so quickly, exactly. So easily fixed.
Again, there were good moments under Frank Lampard and we shouldn't forget that, but good Lord, they look a different team in a very, very short space of time.
Some Chelsea fans got together and there was a massive banner that said something like leader, manager, legend. Like a huge banner that went across like sort of 30 seats along at Stamford Bridge. It obviously was taken down when he got sacked. And some fans clubbed together to buy Frank Lampard the banner. I mean, what's he going to do? Like, is he going to put it up above his front door? What does he do with that massive banner?
Also, I mean, couldn't they have just kept it? It says, leader something legend, right? And what? And then a picture of Frank at the end. Can you just not paint Tuchel's face over Frank's and just leave it there?
I mean, it's a very good idea. And it's better for the environment,
yeah,
isn't it? Multi-use banners. West Ham beat Leeds 2-0. West Ham are a very solid team. Leeds did have a million chances in this game. I love watching Patrick Bamford. He could have scored about 100. But I kind of feel that West Ham deserved it.
Very briefly, so the Scandinavians don't turn up outside my door with pitchforks. Malik Hamzik have signed for IFK Göteborg, which I absolutely have to mention. Because it is probably, in terms of profile, the biggest signing, I think, for any Scandinavian club in the modern era.
Right.
It's quite remarkable. He's torn up his contract with the Dalian Professional in China, and he needed someone to play for going into the Euros. And because of the transfer window in Slovakia, he couldn't go to his home country. So he's signed a short-term deal with IFK Göteborg. Now, excitingly, he's signed until the 30th of August. So he's going to be around for a little bit, a little bit afterwards, the Euros as well. And he's going to play something like 17, 18 games for IFK Göteborg, which is, you know, a superstar, really, going to Sweden. It's great.
When does the season run until, if he's playing till August?
Oh, well, the season runs until late. It's a summer league in Sweden. So
it's sunny all the time. There's no darkness in Sweden, remember. They just play 24 hours a day.
Except in the winter, which is why we can't have the usual European schedule.
Is there no, like, floodlights in Sweden, though? I mean,
No, because they're all used in the saunas, aren't they? They're all used in the saunas, Sid.
There are some of the sort of more northernmost teams there. I think you should see the weather there in the winter before making any calls.
No, but it's to do with the light, at least. You can still have floodlights. Yeah, the cold is a different thing. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's also there being snow everywhere and, you know, minus 20 outside.
I'm sorry to stop you, Lars, but we've run out of time. Thank you, Lars.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thanks, Sid.
You're very welcome.
We're back on Thursday looking back at the Champions League. Barry, Mark Langdon, Johnny Liu are your team for that pod.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.